Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Say you want a revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world.
And with that appropriate music from the time, now we continue our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the American Culture Wars, Decade by Decade. Yes, we're still in 1968, and today we look back on how a divided Democratic Party contributed to the election of Richard Nixon. And yes, there are parallels to how this country elected Donald Trump. My special guest for this history ride, as we fade out the Beatles track from 68, is MSNBC host Lawrence O'Donnell. Many of you know his nightly program, The Last Word, which airs at 10 p.m. Monday through Friday. He has also been an aide to the late Democratic Senator from New York, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and a writer on the West Wing. And this year, or a few months ago, Lawrence published a book that couldn't be more perfect for this, called Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. Lawrence, so nice to have you with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Great to be here.
We've been playing historical audio woven into this series, so let me start with a clip of President Lyndon Johnson, who had won a landslide in 64, as you know, announcing that he would not seek re-election after his popularity had plummeted.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Now, Lawrence, that was such an interesting framing of why he wasn't running again. So often people say they want to spend more time with their family or something like that. He said, in those divided times, he didn't want to devote any time to partisan causes.
Yes, and the notion that a president could not run for re-election while conducting a war had no historical precedent. What had happened was Gene McCarthy broke with the president of his own party, went up to New Hampshire, and I was a high school kid at the time, and so it was my impression that Gene McCarthy won New Hampshire when, in fact, he came in a very strong second, which stunned the president. By the end of the week, Bobby Kennedy jumped into the campaign, and so there were these two very hard-charging Democratic candidates running against the incumbent president for his own nomination. And Johnson really feared Bobby Kennedy much more than Gene McCarthy, even though Gene McCarthy had dealt him that stunning kind of political punch in the nose, as it were, in New Hampshire. And so what Johnson started to see just politically was he would probably be able to hold on to the nomination because the primaries really did not come close to deciding the nomination. Most states didn't have primaries. So the nomination was an inside game in the convention hall. But he increasingly believed the nomination wasn't going to be worth having, that he was probably going to struggle so mightily in his reelection campaign that he literally at that point didn't know how to win it. And this was the master politician, but what he wasn't, when people think of him as a master politician, is the master politician who knew how to win close elections. The close one that he won in Texas, by all reasonable accounts, he stole by manipulating ballot boxes. And he really, you know, he knew how to win a presidential election coming off of the assassination of a president and him inheriting the presidency as a vice president. He was able to win that in a landslide, but that was very much on the emotion of the assassination that was driving him to that gigantic mm-hmm. victory.
And,
he was lost, really, politically.
And I'm going to play another 1 minute of that announcement that he wasn't going to run for re-election. And folks, if you think this is the first time that our country has been divided, obviously you all know better than that anyway, but listen to how divided the incumbent president of the United States made the country sound as he announced that he would not run for re-election.
It is true that a house divided against itself by the spirit of faction, of party, of region, of religion, of race, is a house that cannot stand. There is division in the American house now. There is divisiveness among us all tonight. And holding the trust that is mine as president of all the people, I cannot disregard the peril to the progress of the American people and the hope and the prospects of peace for all peoples. So I would ask all Americans, whatever their personal interests are concerned, to guard against divisiveness and all of its ugly consequences.
So, Lawrence, that's a pretty remarkable clip, and especially for a president who, as a politician and as you were just pointing out, was so supremely confident and such a master power broker through most of his career, he really sounded shaken there.
Yeah, he truly was. He had lost his grip on American politics. He'd lost his understanding of what the dynamics of it were. And the protest movement that had exploded in America in the previous 12 months was nothing like we'd ever seen before. This was a serious and effective and increasingly mature anti-war movement, and America had never really had a serious anti-war movement before. And at this point, we had two anti-war candidates for president, and Lyndon Johnson had never seen that. The country had never seen that. The students all over the country were protesting the war virtually every day. They had begun to burn their draft cards, the boys who had draft cards, which was a federal crime. It had to be made a federal crime in the mid-1960s because it had never occurred to anyone that anyone ever would burn a draft card. And so the LBJ was seeing things, and by the way, the entire society at every level was seeing things all across the culture that it had never seen before. Men with hair hanging over their collars, you know, college-aged boys suddenly with ponytails, beards, pot smoking, the music revolution that was going on every month in the 1960s. It was just a stunning era in every way, and the politics was very much as chaotic as was the music scene or every other part of our culture.
We'll continue with Lawrence O'Donnell and our 1968 edition of The Eights, a brief history of the American culture wars decade by decade. When we continue, we'll play more historical audio from 1968 of those anti-war candidates, Eugene McCarthy, who was a senator from Minnesota, and of course Robert Kennedy, and others. We'll take some of your oral history phone calls from some of you who remember the time and continue to talk with Lawrence O'Donnell, host of The Last Word on MSNBC and author of Playing with Fire, the 1968 election and the transformation of American politics. Stay with us.
Hey there, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
We're from Radiolab.
Yeah.
So, Krul.
Yes.
When was the last time you did something that made you feel really good, like really noble?
You mean like getting up in the bus and letting an older person sit in my seat?
Yeah.
That kind of thing?
Yeah. Something like that, but bigger, better.
Oh.
Awesomer.
17 kids in a den group from the Cub Scouts, all of them with their left shoelaces untied, tied them all. Rights were fine. I did all the left.
That's,
yes.
When I'm thinking of, that's middlingly good. I'm talking like
really?
Cosmically good.
I don't know if I have cosmic.
Well, I'll tell you what. You got 3 minutes?
Yeah.
One phone call to this radio station, under 3 minutes, and you can support everything this radio station does all year round. 3 minutes for a year. That's like,
well, you're
the math
telling
is in
me
your
that
favor.
That would make me feel really good.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, it would. So tell them how.
How is just by going to WNYC.org or by going to your phone and calling 888-376-WNYC, 888-376-9692. This is day one of our spring membership drive here on WNYC, and we are interrupting a few times today to ask you to voluntarily support this non-commercial news organization with a tax-deductible donation. In these perilous times for truth, we are proud to be a listener-supported, not-for-profit station, independent from anything but our own not-for-profit entity, New York Public Radio. So if you listen a lot and you get a lot of news and insight, and in our series, The Eights, a lot of history from different perspectives, as well as maybe some community connection from WNYC, we ask that you be one of the funders. Just go to WNYC.org to help support the station or call 888-376-WNYC, 888-376-9692. We'll continue with Lawrence O'Donnell and your calls and more history clips in our 1968 edition of The Eights coming up. From some rock music of the day, the group Chicago, when they were known as the Chicago Transit Authority, and that song that incorporated chanting from outside the Democratic Convention in 1968 as they chanted "The whole world's watching." We're in our series, The Eights, a brief history of the American culture wars, decade by decade. We are in 1968 as we look back today on how a divided Democratic Party contributed to the election of Richard Nixon. And yes, there are parallels to how this country elected Donald Trump. My special guest for this segment is MSNBC host Lawrence O'Donnell. Many of you know his nightly program, The Last Word, which airs Monday through Friday at 10 p.m. He has also been an aide to the late New York Democratic Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan and a writer on the West Wing. And he's author of the book published a few months ago, Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. And Lawrence, thanks again for giving us some time on this, so obviously relevant to the theme of your book.
Yeah, this is my favorite subject, it turns out.
And listeners, as we've been doing in this series, we invite you to contribute some oral history. And for today's installment, we're going to ask for a very specific thing. Let's see if we can get it. Any of you who were Democrats in 1968, who did you support in the primaries? Robert Kennedy, Eugene McCarthy, or Hubert Humphrey? 212-433-WNYC. Can we get one of each? Any Humphrey vote? Anybody willing to admit this many years later that you did vote for Hubert Humphrey in one of those primaries? Or RFK or Eugene McCarthy? 212-433-9692. And maybe you'll also reminisce on whether you think your party's dysfunction contributed to the election of Richard Nixon. 212-433-9692. And it's even okay if you were not yet of voting age, which was 21 at the time. There were many, many college students, for example, who might have supported Eugene McCarthy, and you remember him as the first presidential candidate of your mind and your heart, even if you couldn't actually cast a vote because you weren't 21 yet. But for anyone who is a Democrat in 1968, let's do some oral history. Who did you support in the primary for president? We're looking for one McCarthy voter to call up and tell us why. One, and we have the McCarthy voters who've volunteered even before I asked, gave out the phone number, looking for an RFK voter from 68 and a Hubert Humphrey Democratic primary voter from 68. And Lawrence, let's listen to clips of those three candidates. McCarthy, who was a senator from Minnesota in 1968 and really broke out, as you were describing earlier, as the anti-Vietnam War candidate who stunned President Johnson in the New Hampshire primary.
We are no longer conducting a kind of educational program with reference to Vietnam and other national problems. No longer conducting a kind of children's crusade to get them away from demonstrations and protests, to keep them busy until they accept the establishment in middle age.
Eugene McCarthy in 1968. And Lawrence, that's a fascinating clip because he kind of wove the counterculture into that. It wasn't just I support or don't support this war policy. It was this whole notion of you're going to grow up and join the establishment in middle age as a bad thing.
That was when the McCarthy campaign and the candidate had matured to the point, especially the candidate, had matured as a candidate to the point where he really understood his audience and he really understood his mandate, and he was able to use his really wide-ranging wit and everything that brought him into this race. When he started, he was terrible. His initial campaign announcement was not even that he was running for president. He didn't even put it that way. He simply said he was going to enter about four primaries, and he wasn't sure whether he was going to enter the New Hampshire primary. And so he started off stumbling, finally got some traction in the last couple of weeks in New Hampshire. And after that, once he had the New Hampshire campaign behind him, he really excelled as a candidate, and then was thrown off course by the entry of Bobby Kennedy, who I would argue it's not so much the dysfunction of the Democratic Party that led to the Nixon win. It was very specifically the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, because as I discovered in my research for the book, and this is not an opinion that I held at the time. I was a high school kid, and I wasn't equipped enough to form this opinion, but that if Bobby Kennedy had not been assassinated, I believe he would have won the nomination in Chicago. He would have appealed to the Humphrey side of the party. He would have appealed to the Gene McCarthy side of the party. He would have come out of there probably very likely with the nomination, and I don't think Richard Nixon had a way of being Bobby Kennedy.
Robert Kennedy was assassinated on June 5th, 1968, after winning that day's California primary. Of course, he was well known to the country already, having been attorney general when his brother was president, 1961 to 63, and he was senator from New York. And he had a very connected, very moving speaking style. So here's a minute of Robert Kennedy in 1968.
No government can sustain international law and order unless it can do so also at home. No country can lead the fight for social justice unless its commitment to its own people is credible and determined, unless it seeks jobs and not the dough for men, unless it feels anguish as long as any of its children are hungry, unless it believes in opportunity for all of its citizens. All across this land. Our future may lie beyond our vision, but it is not beyond our control. Alfred Lord Tennyson once wrote, "The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. I come to you today to say that we can build a newer and better nation. I say we can do so, that we must do so, and that we will do so."
Robert Kennedy in 1968, and Cy in North Babylon. You're on WNYC. Hi, Cy. We've got about 30 seconds to a minute for you. You were a McCarthy voter, right?
I was a district leader for McCarthy in the primary, and friends of mine actually became delegates at the convention, and I was quite concerned about their safety. And we came out of that convention after seeing Daley screaming at Rubikoff, you know, hating Humphrey because he was a sycophant for Johnson. It would be a continuation of Johnson. Our chant was, "Dump the hump, dump the hump, dump the hump." And it was very effective. And I think that's a major contributing factor to why Nixon won.
So I thank you very much. Dorothy in Conover, North Carolina. You're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in, Dorothy.
Thank you, Brian. It's so very nice to hear you in person. just hearing that recording of Bobby Kennedy, I'm on the verge of tears. I knew of Bobby Kennedy's history way back, and some of the shall we say, less savory aspects of some of his acts.
Like wiretapping Martin Luther King?
Yeah. I'm working with J. Edgar Hoover and all of those things. And then it became very clear that when he saw the dogs and the water hoses unleashed on those children in Alabama, I think it was, wasn't it?
Various places, yeah.
That something happened to him. He became a different person. And from that day on, everything that I heard him say or do, just I felt was pure integrity.
Dorothy, thank you so much. And Lawrence O'Donnell, she references, the dogs and the hoses. And another clip that we could have played if we had chosen that one was Robert Kennedy speaking at the funeral of Martin Luther King. Do you agree with the caller that the assassination of King and the events of that followed that, and maybe actions by the police in the South, transformed him?
Every American was transformed in the 1960s. Everyone. So Bobby Kennedy is the one in our politics who we can see the most external transformation. We can see him, because he was so prominent, going from someone who was willing to authorize wiretaps on Martin Luther King Jr. To the completely opposite view of the same situation within a couple of years. In the South, in you had segregationists in 1960 who were no longer segregationists in 1969. Gene McCarthy, the anti-war candidate, voted for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. He was very supportive of Lyndon Johnson's actions in Vietnam up to a point, and then changed his mind. And so everyone in America was changing their minds about all sorts of things in the 1960s, including music and drug use and all sorts of other things. With Bobby Kennedy, we actually see it play out politically. But the roots of his liberalism were always there. He went out and spoke at a convention of Native American tribes in North Dakota in 1963 when he was Attorney General, and no one was paying attention to this. And it was the most advanced liberal a speech you could possibly have given to Native American tribes. It would stand today, word for word, as relevant. And that was long before concerns of the tribes were on any national liberal agenda. And these are among the many surprises that I discovered in researching my book about this campaign. And Bobby Kennedy's everything about Bobby Kennedy now makes perfect sense to me. And at the time, I remember being kind of confused by some of these things when I was in high school.
So we haven't yet heard from the nominee. Of course, President Johnson had to not run for re-election because he had become so unpopular. But his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, ran and beat the anti-war candidate McCarthy. Of course, Kennedy had been killed before the convention. So here is a minute and a half of Hubert Humphrey from his Democratic Convention acceptance speech in 1968.
Yes, the new day is here. Across America, throughout the entire world, the forces of emancipation are at work. We hear freedom's rising chorus. Let me live my own life. Let me live in peace. Let me be free, say the people. And that cry is heard today in our slums, on our farms, and in our cities. It is heard from the old as well as from the young. It is heard in Eastern Europe, and it is heard in Vietnam. And it will be answered by us in how we face the three realities that confront this nation. The first reality is the necessity for peace in Vietnam and in the world. The second reality is the necessity for peace and justice in our cities and in our nation. And the third reality is the paramount necessity for unity, unity in our country.
Hubert Humphrey, who was the Democratic nominee for president in 1968, in his convention acceptance speech. And Jack in Suffern is going to remember being a Humphrey supporter in the Democratic primaries, right, Jack?
That's right, Brian. I was a graduate student in political science at Brooklyn College after graduating from Villanova. And I had read an awful lot about Humphrey, and I really liked him. And I knew he was a liberal. I mean, he was, you know, at the 48 convention and things like that, he was, you know, pushing for civil rights long before Bobby Kennedy or any of the other people. Anyway, my theory on the convention is this. I saw the Chicago police in action. I was also trained, I was a National Guardsman. I was trained in crowd control because that we were scared. We weren't scared about being sent to Vietnam. We were scared about being sent to Newark, New Jersey. Anyway, my theory is the convention, instead of being held in Chicago with their roughneck, bigoted police department, if it would have been held in New York with the, you know, professionalism of the NYPD, that Humphrey would have won.
Interesting. Jack, I'm going to leave it there for time as we go back to our guest, Lawrence O'Donnell, the MSNBC host, who has also written a book called Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. Well, a few things to digest, Lawrence, from that clip and from the caller who supported Humphrey. For one thing, he was... You know, the caller's right, and we had a clip earlier in the series when Humphrey was a young congressman from Minnesota, and he was a firebrand for civil rights when most of the other white Democrats at that time in the, I think, late 40s as well as 50s were not ready for that. But boy, did he sound like the stiff establishment compared to McCarthy or RFK in that clip.
Yeah, that's what 20 years will do. In 1948, Hubert Humphrey was the conscience of the Democratic Party and in many ways the conscience of American politics. He was what was then considered an extreme liberal, and he was extremely inspiring to the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. By 1968, he found himself on the complete other side of the party. He was the establishment. He was part of prosecuting this war in Vietnam that the left of the party was completely opposed to. And, you know, Hubert Humphrey, we have to remember, lost this presidential election by less than 1% of the vote. He closed to within 1% of the vote with Richard Nixon. So if you change any one thing, you can turn this into a win for Humphrey. And Jack's idea is something that I hadn't considered before. My book is full of what ifs. What if Bobby Kennedy had left the stage on the other side instead of where Sirhan was? But that what if the convention were held somewhere else, is fascinating because a commission that studied the riots after the convention concluded that it was a police riot, and it put the blame completely on Mayor Daley and the Chicago police for the way they assaulted the crowd when the crowd was in a completely peaceable stance in relation to the police. And so if we had that convention in New York City and if the NYPD had behaved differently from the Chicago PD, then perhaps Richard Nixon would not have been sitting at home watching the convention with glee because of all of the madness that was occurring outside of the convention hall and in the convention hall. If the Democrats had been able to run a calmer convention in a different city, then could Hubert Humphrey had gained 1% more of the vote? Probably.
So today we have focused on the Democrats in the 1968 election. Tomorrow, with other guests, we will look at Richard Nixon riding a populist backlash to the culture wars as well as to some of the politics kind of candidate. And maybe, Lawrence, you can give us a little push into that by giving us just, you know, a minute or so on how you would compare Nixon as a populist backlash culture wars candidate to Donald Trump?
Well, Nixon adopted an idea that was really begun by George Wallace, and that was to identify the concept of law and order as being an anti-civil rights concept. You knew what George Wallace meant when he said it, and Nixon heard that, and Nixon realized he was going to have to appeal to the South. The only way for Nixon to win was he was going to have to win the South. He was going to have to be the Republican who took the South away from the Democrats, and he did that by adopting a lot of George Wallace's rhetoric wherever he could. And by the time Donald Trump was running for president, the guy who ran George Wallace's 1968 presidential campaign told me that when he listened to Donald Trump, he was hearing George Wallace, that Donald Trump had lifted so much of his onstage performance from George Wallace, both in the specifics of his lines and in the way he dealt with protesters and saying, you know, he wanted to punch them in the mouth and all of that kind of stuff. We saw all of that in the George Wallace 1968 campaign.
More on that tomorrow with Cokie Roberts and John Dean. For today, we thank Lawrence O'Donnell, host of The Last Word, weeknights at 10 p.m. on MSNBC, and author of Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. He also has a reissue coming of a book that he had previously written called Deadly Force, A Police Shooting and My Family's Search for the Truth. I invite you to come back on when that book is re-released, if you'd like to. And Lawrence, thank you for providing so much historical perspective today.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.